The Canadian band of the AEF presents
The Canada Show.
Yes, it's music for Canadians, for the men and women of Canada serving overseas and for the Allied forces everywhere. Music of distinction and style by the Canadian band of the AEF under the direction of Captain Bob Farnham. Songs of the day by Privates Joan Dallas and Paul Carpenter. And the Canada Show chorus with Private Jerry Travers. In the guest spotlight, Vincent Tilsley's master singers. Streamline entertainment for frontline listening, so take 30 and take it easy, will you? And that, in the words of the opening number, is an order from the Army.
You gotta smile and be happy, sing and be gay. Take all your worries and take them away. And have a good time, you're on duty today. That's an order from the Army. You gotta just take it easy, gently relax. Run to your wedding and off with your pack. You won't have to pay the amusement tax. That's an order from the Army.
Like Glenn Miller, Bob Farnham had also been leading an orchestra in his native country.
Previously to coming over to Britain, the band traveled across Canada recruiting, doing shows. It was a rather big show, similar to the American one, This is the Army. We ended that tour of Canada in the spring 1944 and reformed as the band of the AEF, which came to Britain in the summer.
However, in addition to pumping out entertainment, the AEF program was a vital link between the forces on different fronts. There were news bulletins every hour, as well as regular programs keeping a check on the fighting's progress.
Just a few minutes ago, the fighter cover showed up, and right behind them came those lovely supply planes that you can hear up above us now. Yesterday and this morning, our supplies came, and they were dropped in the wrong place. The enemy got them. But now these planes have come over and they've dropped them right dead over us. Everybody is cheering and clapping, and they just can't give vent to their feelings about what a wonderful sight this is.
Stanley Maxted, reporting from Arnhem. As Christmas 1944 approached, plans were made for a special broadcast from recently liberated Paris to coincide with the American band's visit. It was arranged because the Home Service wanted to link the troops in France with their families at home. But first, Nat Peck and his associates had to stockpile a large number of pre-recorded programs.
We were in that studio in Bedford for really 18 hours at a go. I mean, trying to get this thing done. Doing a schedule that was absolutely incredible.
Glenn Miller himself was planning to fly over separately from the band, a decision with which Cecil Madden was not at all happy.
You are not to go in a private plane. I said you go with your boys in the three Dakotas on the day that you are supposed to go, which was supposed to have been December the 15th, the day he did actually go, but he didn't, unfortunately, go with any. He went with in a private small plane, which was strictly what he shouldn't have done. But the thing was that we never saw him again.
Meanwhile, in Paris, the band, among them Nat Peck, waited for Glenn to appear.
We were wondering if he was off on one of his little escapades. He's prone to that for a tiny bit. And so nobody really worried that much, because he did have a way of disappearing for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days at a time, and only a few of the people knew where he was. And we presumed that it was something like this. And inasmuch as our concert schedule was not going to hit immediately, nobody was immediately concerned.
The news finally broke on Christmas Eve that Glenn Miller was missing and that no trace of his plane could be found. It fell to chief arranger Jerry Gray to take over as conductor.
Next morning, Christmas Day, the band got together in the theater to rehearse the big show. It was dark and cold, and any theater is dark and cold at a morning rehearsal. And that winter in Paris, it was dark and cold most of the time. Lieutenant Don Haynes got up and told the boys about the announcement, in case any of them didn't know. Then we got to work. I had to try to set everything just the way Glenn would have wanted it, to make the broadcast sound as if he was still out in front leading his band. Well, I think it did. Anyway, the boys seemed to like it. Understand, I was proud and glad to do the job. But I don't ever want to do a job like that again.
Glenn Miller's disappearance was a blow. Not only to the AAFP, but to popular music in general. As the new year arrived, life in the AAFP went on with the mixture as before.
Command Performance USA, the greatest entertainers in America, as requested by you, the fighting men of the United States Armed Forces throughout the world. Command Performance, presented this week and every week, till it's over, over there.
In this program, we bring you news every hour on the hour.
Then, shortly after VE Day, it was decided to close down the AEF program as the Allied armies were ensconced in their occupation zones and ready to set up their own broadcasting services. July the 28th, 1945, was chosen as the date on which the AEFP would end, and despite early misgivings, the Allied Expeditionary Forces program had proved to be an outstanding success.
And so we come to the end of our job, or should I say assignment, on D-Day plus 417. This is Margaret Hubble saying good night to you for the last time in the AEF program. And I can think of no better way of saying goodbye to you than by repeating the words of General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Goodbye, and wherever your new activities may take you, good luck and Godspeed.
That was Victory by Radio. The presenter was Gene Metcalf, and the program was compiled and written by David Ryder, with additional research by Brian Thompson and Jack Dobbs. Production for by Ken Evans for the Transcription Service of the BBC, London.
Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Yes, it is Thursday, December 8th today, but as the music suggests, our communications magazine Media Network in 23 minutes has a wartime character today. One of the broadcasting organizations we'll be meeting calls itself UBCU.
Ungentlemanly Broadcasting Corporation Unlimited.
But first, let's come back to today. You're on Radio Netherlands, and we start with current affairs and a bulletin of world news.
Our thanks there to the Newsline team. And next from Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, Media Network, our weekly communications magazine, which is in a documentary mood.
Wartime deception. The secrets behind the more unusual clandestine broadcasts to and from occupied Europe. Part 1. The Research Units in the Tower. The programs presented by Jonathan Mudd. If you'd been listening to a shortwave radio here in Europe between 1939 and 45, the bands would have sounded very different back then. International radio listening was a risky business. In many parts of Nazi-occupied Europe, even the possession of a radio could earn you the death penalty. Despite that threat, people were listening more than ever, undercover in many cases. Those in the armed forces had access to good receivers, and naturally a lot of news travelled by word of mouth. Before we illustrate some of the resistance radio that could be heard, let's put the shortwave medium into context. With no satellites in existence, communications over any distance, be it civil or military, went by shortwave radio. Because Morse code could penetrate the static better than the human voice, most secret agents from both sides used Morse code to communicate. It was also less conspicuous to be tapping away than shouting into a microphone when you might be overheard. But there were plenty of voices on the bands too. News from Canada being relayed to the troops in Europe.
the farmers of Canada are warming themselves this summer against their old enemies, black flies in Saskatchewan, willow flies in Manitoba, and grasshoppers in British Columbia.
Allied military units used to issue official communiques for the press agencies, Allied broadcasting stations, and anyone else who was listening, including the enemy. News from the Southwest Pacific Area headquarters, for instance. Most people didn't need to search the dial for weak military communiques. There were, of course, the regular broadcasting stations.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is a special bulletin read by John Snow.
And on the other side of the political spectrum, there was Radio Tokyo with its English service.
Once again, our time is up, and your MC of the Hino Maruana must say, Oyasumi no Sai. We hope you have enjoyed our Christmas program, and that they have served in some small way to let you know how your boys are living as prisoners of war in far-off Japan. We invite you to be with us again at this time tomorrow evening. This is your MC wishing you all a very Merry Christmas from Bohina Marawawa. Good night, all. You are listening to Radio Tokyo.
This was in Britain, treated to the rather menacing voice of William Joyce, broadcasting from Berlin.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichs in ambush. Station Bremen and station DXB on the 31-meter band.
The studios may have been in Berlin, but many of those nightly Nazi broadcasts came from mobile transmitters. Roy Neal was the European Program Director for the American Forces Network in Frankfurt just after the war. He recalls how the Germans did it.
Well, as a matter of fact, one of the most ingenious devices that the Nazis dreamed up was their system of international broadcasting to prevent their transmitters from being bombed out. As you know, a radio station is an automatic target because, electronically speaking, it could be found so easily. We use them, as a matter of fact, to vector our aircraft from one point to another. For the most part, Nazi propaganda stemmed from Berlin. It was easily controllable from there. And what they did was feed from our Berlin studios through the landlines, broadcast circuits and stuff. A Class A circuits is what we would have called them in the broadcast business. They'd feed that down the line, and then the transmitters were moved around like chessmen on a chessboard.
The special broadband telephone lines to carry the studio sound from Berlin to the mobile transmitters were well planned before the war. They followed the major motorway routes. Every few kilometers, there was a concrete box where engineers could plug in.
Then they put in 100,000-watt transmitters, truck-mounted, with huge trailers, even power supplies in the rear. They would then run these transmitters up to the nearest point of contact, plug in, go on the air, stay on the air for 2, maybe 3 hours, unplug, and be on to another destination, and that way the Allies couldn't bomb out the transmitters.
But what about the antennas?
The antennas came out with the trucks. They were beautiful antennas that could be cranked up from a fixed position. You still see that kind of antenna today. The only thing is, today when you see that sort of antenna being reeled out of a truck, you see a microwave dish up on top of it, or a dish that can be pointed at the nearest satellite.
And the powers weren't really as much as 100 kilowatts.
That was practically their standard broadcast power, 100,000 watts.
These mobile transmitters were handy for other, more covert purposes. In December 1939, the Germans created a shortwave clandestine station in the French language, the awakening of peace.
Vous écoutez le réveil de la paix. Attention la France. Restez à l'écoute.
The station wasn't peaceful at all. It pretended to come from near Paris, though probably it was broadcast from transmitters in Poland. It told listeners that German Jews who'd escaped from Nazi Germany to France were really a network of spies and should be mistrusted. It spread rumors that the French government was about to make a run for it, some 4 months before they really did leave Paris. In April 1940, a second French station began, taking the name of the French communist newspaper of the day.
Radio Humanité vous parle. La voix d'une France socialiste.
It tried to win support for the Germans amongst the socialist circles.
but its acid tone and boring style wasn't very effective. In February 1940, as well as English broadcasts by William Joyce announcing as coming from Berlin, Dr. Goebbels started the first of several clandestine voices from Germany aimed towards Britain.
Attention! This is the new British broadcasting station.
That station later became Workers' Challenge. Supposedly coming from somewhere in the British Midlands, it denounced Churchill's leadership and used obscene language to attack capitalism in general. But it had a curious opening tune for a station supposedly coming from the Midlands. It was really a Scottish air.
On the bonny, bonny banks of
Just before the war started, Englishman Harold Robin had been working as an engineer in Liechtenstein. He was busy with a project to start high-power commercial radio in that tiny European country, wedged between Switzerland and Austria. It should have become another Radio Luxembourg, but with war clouds looming, Robin was advised to get back to England. By 1940, he'd become involved with running short clandestine broadcasts into occupied France, now overrun by the Germans. The first morale booster to the French resistance was rather primitive.
The very first one was a French broadcast from a communications station in Gloucestershire in a place called North Cerny. And we did the first broadcast to France from a caravan using a 5-kilowatt transmitter. It soon became obvious that this was really a drop in the ocean, and we were told to expand.
In the English county of Buckinghamshire, north of London, they found the ideal site for 2 7.5-kilowatt transmitters at a place called Gorcott. Another transmitter site with identical equipment went up in the nearby village of Pottsgrove.
The studio was a very fine country house in Buckinghamshire called Ravenden Towers. And this was taken over by requisition. The idea was to take the people from the countries taken by Germany into a secure accommodation in around Ravenden. Mostly these were old houses, rectories and so on. They must have had about 15 of these houses. And a crew of, for example, the French would go into one of these houses and would live there and be guarded, closely guarded, by a keeper who was in charge of them for mostly security and also the program material.
What were they worried about? I mean, I can understand them wanting to guard the Germans and the Italians, but why guard the French?
Well, that was a special reason for the fact that there were more than one French program, and these had to be kept very separate because one group did not know that the other was operating. And by the end of the operation, there were as many as 8 French programs of up to F8. We numbered them by simple F123. We got to F8, and they were very antagonistic to the other groups. So these were both grounded and securely scripted, well away from any other groups. Now this happened from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. The group would come in, make its program, be signed for by the keeper, and then the disc consisted all on 16-inch vinyl discs, and then carried to the broadcasting station by car and broadcast appropriate number of times. Sometimes it was every hour, sometimes it was every other hour, and some of them were even every half hour.
Keeping the rival French groups apart was quite a problem, but each was aimed at a different sector of French society. There was Workers' Radio, run by a spokesman of the French trade unions.
Ici, Radio Travail.
Another was called Radio Inconnu, or Radio Unknown.
Radio Inconnu!
That station pretended to operate from the suburbs of Paris and advocated all types of passive resistance. Then there was the voice of the Gaullist movement, directly attacking the Vichy government.
Radio Gaulle.
And then a station that used a real French priest. He conducted Catholic Mass on the air, and his sermons were critical of the way the Nazis treated religion.
Ici la France catholique. Ici la France catholique. Mes bien chers frères, cette émission sera consacrée uniquement à la prière.
Although in its infant stage, the secret activity was starting to generate unwanted activity from within other parts of the British government. A presentation disc was made for a very special visit to the clandestine radio headquarters. On it, one of those involved in the organisation, Colonel Gambier Parry, explains their predicament.
It is much easier to disguise the transmissions from the enemy than from inquisitive officials in this country. Some months ago, a certain department set about locating our first station. Their first conclusion was somewhere in India. That seemed to be the wrong end of the stick. Further off became the suspect area. The final compromise is recorded by the laconic entry in an official file. Illicit enemy broadcasting station located in Syria.
The four shortwave transmitters in Buckinghamshire put out other clandestine voices. Initially, there were two for Italy. There was Radio Italy.
Attenzione, attenzione. Parla Radio Italia.
And then Radio Liberty, which revealed curious intimate details of Mussolini's private life.
Attenzione, attenzione. Qui parla Radio Libertà.
In the space of 1 year, more than 20 of these freedom voices were conjured up. Some of the Italian voices were short-lived because the workers and farmers that the stations tried to reach quite obviously didn't have shortwave radios. The Dutch language station was also short-lived because the Dutch government in exile in London was doing enough morale-boosting back in the Netherlands thanks to airtime they had on the BBC under the name Radio Oranje or Radio Orange. For southeastern Europe, there were more successful short broadcasts aimed at Yugoslavia, Bulgaria and Romania. The Slavic presenter started his talk by whistling a traditional folk song whose refrain went, out with them, out with them.
Ovdje slobodna Hrvatska radio postaja Zrinski. Ovdje slobodna Hrvatska radio postaja Zrinski.
Engineer Harold Robbins spent several hours in the basement of Waverden Towers until they put enough echo on the Bulgarian voice to give it a ghostly feeling. There was a station aimed at Austria too, Radio Red Vienna. Red being a reference to its socialist character.
Wir österreichische Sozialisten begrüßen diesen Schritt unserer russischen und englischen Genossen. Die Spaltung der internationalen Arbeiterbewegung, insbesondere die Spaltung der deutschen Arbeiter in Sozialdemokraten und Kommunisten, hat viel zur Niederlage der Arbeiter im Kampf gegen den Hitlerfaschismus beigetragen.
And of course, there was a station directed toward Germany. On November the 10th, 1940, its clock tuning signal first appeared on shortwave.
Achtung, Achtung! Hier ist der Sender der Europäischen Revolution. Wir sprechen für alle, die zum Schweigen verdammt sind.
Overall, those in charge of the operation were quite pleased.
In our own engineering headquarters, we are unashamedly christened the UBCU, the letters UBCU, or Ungentlemanly Broadcasting Corporation Unlimited.
In 1941, the former Berlin correspondent of the English newspaper The Daily Express joined the secret radio operations centre in Buckinghamshire. Sefton Delmer had been born in the German capital of Australian parents and knew the Third Reich well.
Delmer came in quite a bit later and immediately saw that the way it was going was quite unsatisfactory and was unprofessional, as he used to say. Now, his idea was that these broadcasts should not just be freedom stations, they should be something a bit more. And he coined the phrase black broadcasting. That is to make them in every way appear to be coming from within the country, in this case, Germany.
One of the wartime broadcasters behind the microphone was Peter Weichmann.
The general format, the introduction, usually a march, German march, of course, way in which the news was presented, I mean, the enemy, of course, was always the Allies, and so on, our troops were the German troops, and so on. That's the sort of superficial way in which one did it, but also to some extent by the use of what we used to call cover items, in other words, straight German news taken from the German news agency, which we received simultaneously through a Hellschreiber, a technical device for transmitting news agency stuff.